So today, the main purpose of the second lecture is to apply path integral quantization to quantization of a first example of a genuine quantum field, namely the scalar field, bosonic scalar field of Klein-Gordon. Thank you. Okay, but first, quantization of the scalar field, but first I'd like to come back in particular in order to answer to some question. Well, I answered privately to some of the view. Thank you. After the lectures, but why? Euclidean time is interesting. Okay. Oops. Okay. So, because I introduced this concept of going from real time t to imaginary time by writing that t equal minus I tau, where tau is imaginary time. And my main argument, as far as I remember, is just that, well, physicists and mathematicians, when you have, they have a real quantity, likes to consider it, to complexify it. It's often useful, but that's of course not a satisfactory explanation for a physicist. So, then I already gave an argument which says that using imaginary time makes a connection between path integrals and statistical physics. Factor from the point of view of mathematics probability BPT theory, because basically in Euclidean time, in imaginary time, the trajectory are random walks. The genuine random walk of a mathematician, namely what they call the Brownian process. Or Wiener process. Okay, so that's the first connection, and that's a connection I think you have already discussed in the statistical mechanical course, which has been discussing random paths, random loops, random walks, random loops, models, etc. Okay, so the second, so this is a connection with classical physics. So it's, there is randomness, but the randomness comes from, you know, classical random probability. And you have white noise, a particle is subjected to a white noise, so it doesn't evolve in a deterministic way, but it's random. So that's classical physics. Classical physics. So now, a second point where it's useful has to deal with quantum statistical physics. So the statistical physics of a quantum system. And this is very easy to see. It comes from the following fact. Remember that the evolution operator for a simple quantum system, like an harmonic oscillator, a particle in an harmonic well, is just exponential of T over I h bar times the Hamiltonian operator. This is an operator. Okay. And when you go to imaginary time, you get the imaginary time evolution operator, which is just the exponential of minus tau over h bar times the Hamiltonian of the system. Okay? So now, this is a bounded Hermitian operator. So it associates a probability to each state of the particle. So now take its trace and divide, normalize this operator by dividing by its trace. So consider the operator rho of tau, which is exponential of minus tau over h bar Hamiltonians divided by the trace of this operator. Okay? So this operator is, so now this is an operator, so it's, we should call it rho hat. Rho hat is Hermitian and positive definite. And its trace is 1. Okay. So it's a density matrix. So it describes, it doesn't describe a pure state, but it describes a mixed quantum states. Okay, I hope all of you are familiar with this concept of mixed quantum states. So it's a statistical superposition of pure states. It can be viewed as a statistical superposition of pure states. And what is this state? Well, it's very simple. I already wrote that yesterday. If you consider that you have energy eigenstates I with an energy EI, let's order them, then of course you can write rho hat as sum over I of the some probability p I, where p I is just, well, the weight associated to this state, so it's exponential minus e I, well, it's exponential minus tau over h bar e I, normalized by the sum over the states of exponential of minus 2 over h bar e I. And this sum of probabilities sums to 1. Okay. And so, what is this? It's the exponential of some factor times the energy. So this, you can rewrite just as the Boltzmann weight. This is exponential, it's just the Boltzmann weight. Boltzmann, does it have 1 N or 2 N? I never remember. Boltzmann, why is German this guy? So it should be 2 N. Wait. That you can rewrite as exponential of minus 1 over KBT EI for a system with temperature T. So, this is a distribution probability of a quantum system at temperature T. So, you have, we have our small quantum systems, for instance, an harmonic oscillator. This is a small quantum system. It exchanges energy with a big thermostat. Such that it has an effective temperature T. Well, the evolution operator of this quantum system at imaginary time tau is nothing but, well, up to a normalization, the density matrix of this state, which is called a Gibbs states, quantum states, because this is just the Gibbs distribution. Of a system at thermal equilibrium. at temperature T. And so you see that it's just, you know, a mathematical analogy. But the relation between the parameter tau in this mathematical object and the temperature of the system this describes is just, of course, that tau over h bar is 1 over kb t. Or, in other words, t kb t is h bar divided by tau. Okay. And, well, in statistical physics, what does t measures, in fact? Well, t is a term, an effective, but t amounts to the whether thermal fluctuations are big or small. If a system is at low temperature, it's almost frozen, and it has it experiences very small thermal fluctuation. If it's at an absolute temperature of zero, there are no thermal fluctuations. The system is frozen in its ground state. So this is thermal fluctuation. While in a quantum system, h bar, in some sense, measures the amount of quantum fluctuations. Of course, quantum fluctuations have a very deep structure. They are not just measured by a simple number, but basically h bar measures in the unit of system you are considering whether quantum fluctuations are important or not. Fluctuation, not, for instance, interference effects or entanglement effects, which of course takes into account h bar, but may be large, even if a system, quantum system, can be described by a system with very small quantum fluctuations. Okay. Nevertheless, so going from real time to imaginary times means that there is a mathematical relationship, which is quite deep, between quantum fluctuation in a thermal, in a quantum system, and thermal fluctuation in a system. So that's another way to view the relation between quantum physics and statistical physics. But that's different. Here, we are considering quantum. So we are considering a quantum system at thermal equilibrium. So we are considering the thermodynamics of a quantum system. Okay. In order to finish this consideration, let me just mention something that probably might already mention to you, which is that how do we compute this object, the trace of this evolution operator? Of course, in quantum statistical in statistical mechanics, this object, the sum of the Boltzmann weights over kBT EI is just called the partition function of the systems. And out of the partition function, you take its log, you get the free energy, and through some law of thermodynamics, you get the internal energy, you get the enthalpy, etc., etc. So, okay. Now, so what is this object? This object here is just the denominator of this. So this object is just, for our quantum system, z of t is just the trace of exponential minus tau over h bar, the quantum Hamiltonian. So now let's go back to our quantum system, for instance, an harmonic oscillator. But instead of expressing the operator in the basis of energy eigenvectors, let's go back to position eigenstates. So let's go back to position uh, eigenstates Q for a system where h bar is p squared over 2m plus v of q squared, a simple system of a particle in a potential. Okay. For the trace is just, well, integral over dq from minus infinity to plus infinity, since I'm in a system with potential with energy levels in the q direction, of, well, this object of this, which is ue of tau. The trace is the sum of the diagonal elements of an operator, matrix element of an operator, and this becomes, in the basis of position eigenstate, an integral over position eigenstate. Okay. But we have seen that this can be written as a path integral in Euclidean time. So we have seen that this can be written as well, integral over some histories of particle in Euclidean time, with the condition that q at time zero is q, and q at time tau, at Euclidean time tau. This is the initial condition. This is the final condition. But the final condition here, since we take the trace, has to be equal to the initial condition. Okay? And then we get the weight factor exponential minus the Euclidean act, well, minus 1 over h bar, the Euclidean action of this trajectory. Well, now if we represent Euclidean time tau, I sum of a trajectory which start at q and end up at q with an Euclidean action, which is an integral from zero to tau of d sigma, m over 2 q dot squared of sigma plus v of q of sigma. Okay. But of course, this is just this matrix element. Now we have, in addition, to integrate over the initial equal final condition. And so you see that you integrate over trajectories in Euclidean time that start from a point, end up at the same point, but we don't fix anymore the initial equal point. So this is just something which is integral over dq, exponential, well, e minus 1 over h bar, the Euclidean action q, over periodic in Euclidean time, in imaginary trajectories, where the only boundary condition is just that q of zero is called q of tau. You don't fix them of the same thing. So in other words, the partition function is given by a path integral for periodic Euclidean time. And what's the period? The period is just tau, the evolution time in Euclidean time, which is given, the relation with the temperature is given by this relation. And if I invert it, I get just tau equal h bar of kBT, which is a simple but very important relation. And that's very general. I gave it on the example of a single particle in one dimension in the potential, but this relation is general. So it's simple, but it's general and it impacts quite deep. Because it means that considering a quantum system at finite temperature, is more or less equivalent to consider the system at periodic Euclidean time. And using the path integral formulation is a simple way to view this, but in fact, you can also view this analogy using just operators, so in the canonical formalism. And there is a whole mathematical formalism, interesting mathematical formalism related to this analogy, which is called, I just forgot what is, is designed by an acronym, GLIM.
I'm sorry?
No, you don't know it. I just, my memory has a.
Tell me the Takisaki theory that has.
It's something much simpler than that. Yeah. It's related to the Tomita-Saki theory for type 3 factor in the theory of von Neumann algebra, but that's something much more involved. No, it's called the. I'm sorry. This is going to come back. It's the bound condition. Okay, I prefer to forget it, but there is a. When my memory will switch back, I will give you the name. Okay, it's in the load. Okay. So this is the second reason why Euclidean time is interesting. Yes?
This question makes me feel that really, like quantum field theory seems to be the same as statistical field theory. So what's the
This means that there is a deep relation between quantum theory and statistical mechanics. There is a deep relation. But for instance, I'm here considering only a system at finite temperature and at thermal equilibrium. Thermal equilibrium means that it's, for instance, its time correlation function are time invariant. So there is no consideration of evolution. So if you want to deal with out of equilibrium quantum statistical mechanics, then things become much more complicated. So this is equilibrium. Okay. Well, this can be generalized to non-equilibrium statistical mechanics. But that's more involved. Anyway, there are generalizations of this imaginary time formalism that are useful. It's not the full answer, but that's very useful. And this mixes real and imaginary time. And that's called in physics the two-time, if you want, Schwinger-Keldysh formalism. And I think I'm giving an example of this in the lecture notes that you are going to have if you don't have them already. Okay. Well, I wouldn't have no time to discuss the third interesting, but let's mention just by word that, in fact, considering histories of a system for complex time, and not only real time, is interesting to deal with specifically quantum systems, like for instance, tunneling effect or decay rates of a particle in an unstable potential. I alluded to that last week. So this is the third reason here, and we just write with word that complex time is interesting for tunneling phenomenon, which is a typical quantum phenomenon, but it can be described as some kind of semi-classical theory, and also by studying decay rates in quantum physics. So, okay. But let me stop there because I hope to have some time to deal with the quantum field theory. Okay? Any question? Okay. Okay, so let me switch to now. Now, quantum field theory. And I haven't explained why imaginary time is called Euclidean, but I'm going to explain that, if you don't know that already, in a minute. Okay. So now, I'm going to consider the simplest quantum field theory that you have been studied at length in the QFT1 course, which is the Klein-Gordon or scalar non-interacting, which means free quantum field. Free means non-interacting. Okay. And, well, this is just the object you obtain by quantizing the system, the fields, which obeys the classical Klein-Gordon equation. Okay, so what is a classical field? So we have our space-time. So let me mention, write this as time and Higgs. But now I am dealing with a quantum field theory, so this is an extended object. So space has at least one dimension. Okay. And so, so space-time is Minkowski. Space-time with dimension, so let me denote it m of 1 and d minus 1. So the dimension of space-time is d. There is one dimension of time, d minus 1 dimension of space. And so a vector, a space-time vector x has a time component and a space component that I'm going to denote space component by vector with an arrow, of course. And the Minkowski matrix is taken to be the line element is taken to be, and here, of course, I'm going to use the opposite notation as in QFT1. Because I'm used to that, and that's this. So I'm using a time where the signature of the metric is minus plus this time, and this is space. Okay. So I think this metric is called the West Coast metric in the literature because it has been used by many physicists in California and around, while the opposite sign. So this is the east coast, the west coast. While, of course, the east coast metric has ds squared equal dt squared minus dx squared. But of course, you can switch easily from one to the other one. And well, it's not completely clear why it's called, well, I know historically it's called west coast and east coast, but for instance, well, there is, of course, with all examples, there are counterexamples. And I think one of the most prominent counterexamples is a book by Weinberg, which used this metric while he has been for some time walking on the east coast before going to, well, middle to Texas. Okay, which is in between. Okay, so I'm going to use this. So this is, of course, this is a theory in real time. And in real time, so what do we have? We have a field, phi, which depends on, say, point in space-time, which is scalar. I mean, scalar means, mean it's a real field. Its component, there is one component, and it's a real number. It's a real field, and its scalar means that it has one component, namely that spin is zero. While, of course, you know that spin one half Dirac field have in general four components, or two if they are Majorana, and electromagnetic field that we have seen in QFT1 has also, it's a vector potential, so it has four components too, with a constraint, positive H field, etc. Okay, so it's spin zero, so it's scalar. Okay, and of course this field is, if you note it in terms of component, is a function of phi of t and x. So if you are thinking in terms of what is the configuration space of this field, the configuration space of this file is that you take a time slice, okay? And you consider on the time slice here, what's the value of the field at all points on this slice? So this slice is a space-like, the space-like subspace. So a configuration of the field is phi t, which is basically the function, the value of all the field phi of t on x for x belonging to space, which is d minus one dimensional space time. So that's a configuration. And well, the equation of motion for this field are the Klein-Gordon equation, classical. So they are derived from an action. And what is the action for this term? So the action, of course, for field history, field S of phi, it's an integral over time of a Lagrangian. But now the Lagrangian depends on the field configuration and its time derivative. So you have a Lagrangian which depends on phi of t and the phi dot of t. This is a Lagrangian. But since it's a local field, the Lagrangian density is going to depend on the integral of a space of this. So this is going to be integral dt, integral over dx, and we integrate over the d minus one spatial dimension of a Lagrangian density. And the Lagrangian density contains two terms. It contains the kinetic part, as for the ordinary particle. So the kinetic part is one half of dt of phi squared. This is a kinetic part. And it contains a potential part, contents minus the potential energy. So the minus the potential energy contains a term which involves the spatial derivative of x of phi squared and internal energy, local energy, which is minus m squared over 2 phi squared. So this is the energy, and this is, well, let's write it like that. This is the potential energy. Okay. And it must contain special derivative, otherwise it will be just a collection of independent particles, not independent particle, staying at the same place. And it has to be this coefficient in order to have Lorentz invariance. And of course, by choosing this metric, I've chosen the fact, the normalization, where the speed of light is 1. So if you want to remind that you have a speed of light, just add a c squared here. Okay. Okay. And of course, from this action, which is local action, if you take the variation of it, you get the Euler-Lagrange equation, and the Euler-Lagrange equation are minus dt squared of phi plus dx squared of phi minus m squared of phi equals 0, which is the Klein-Gordon equation, if I made no mistakes with the sign. I think I made no mistakes, because if you consider plane waves, dt phi plus m squared phi equals 0 means that you have oscillating waves. Okay. So the solution of this, this is a Klein-Gordon equation, and the solution are plane waves. Okay, one that you have been studying in QFT1. And quantizing by canonical quantization those plane waves, making them quantum objects, leads to the canonical quantization of the field involving creation and annihilation of operator of those plane waves modes. Okay, so this is the action. And of course, you see immediately that this is Lorentz invariance. You can rewrite it as d phi with the metric, nine metric. Okay, so this is for Klein-Gordon field, classical Klein-Gordon field at real time. Okay. Now, what about considering this classical theory at imaginary time? Let me do this at imaginary time. So imaginary time means promoting t from a real variable to a complex variable, writing t equal minus I tau, and applying the rule that we have written for ordinary quantum mechanics. Okay, so if we have imaginary time, then it means that instead of considering a field that depends on t and x, we consider a field, let me call it an Euclidean field, which is a function of tau and x. So now we consider tau and x as a component of a Euclidean vector x. Let's I'm going to explain why this is an Euclidean. It's Euclidean for the following reason. If we replace t by I tau, the line element ds squared becomes minus times minus I squared tau. It becomes d tau squared plus dx squared. So we get a space-time with signature plus. So Minkowski space-time becomes the ordinary d-dimensional space-time with the Euclidean metric, the ordinary flat matrix. Okay. And Lorentz invariance becomes rotation invariance. Because the transformation that preserves this matrix are just rotation elements of the group O of D, okay, or SOD, okay? And Poincaré group becomes a group of rotation and translation, so it becomes the Euclidean group of Euclidean transformation, BD, which is a semi-direct product of RD times O of D, or the opposite. I never remember the exact definition of a semi-direct product. And so, you know, the geometry of Minkowski space-time becomes just the geometry of ordinary d-dimensional space-time. And that's why tau is called Euclidean. You could have guessed. Okay, and so we can rewrite this just as the component x0, x1, xd minus 1. So time here, Euclidean time is just the first component of d-dimensional space-time. While here, t is x0, but with the metric. Okay, so that's why imaginary part is Euclidean. Okay, and that's very general. That's of course not specific to the Klein-Gordon field. We have not specific. Okay, so now let's apply the rule that we gave yesterday for defining quantum system at Euclidean space-time. Well, we have seen that we have to replace the action by the Euclidean action. We have to replace the action S phi by an Euclidean action, which is a function of this Euclidean field. I forget about the Euclidean subscript. If you are uneasy, keep in mind that this is Euclidean. And what's the relation? The Euclidean action is simply obtained by keeping the kinetic part and changing the sign here. So the Euclidean action is just now, so this is now the action about d, and I'm going to use this x0 here. So it's dx0 integral dx, for the remaining d-dimensional aspects. Here I have one half of dx0 pi squared, and here I have plus one half of dx pi squared plus m squared over 2 pi squared. And of course, this is just one half of dx pi squared, which is rotationally invariant. And so, the Klein-Gordon equation, what does the Klein-Gordon equation become? The Klein-Gordon becomes, well, this is change, this change sign, this doesn't change sign. So the Klein-Gordon equation becomes minus the Laplacian of phi plus m squared phi equals zero. Well, now nabla is the ordinary Laplacian operator in d dimension. It's d squared over dx0 squared plus etc. plus d squared over dxd minus 1 squared. It's ordinary Laplacian. So the Klein-Gordon equation, which is what's called an elliptic equation, we describe the propagation of waves, becomes the Euclidean Klein-Gordon equation, which is a parabolic equation. And the solution of those equations, this equals zero, are not plane waves, they are growing or decreasing exponentials. Okay, so now we have our, and this is the Euclidean action. Okay. So now, well, we have everything to quantize this object. We have now I have to make a clever use of, I don't use it. So now we can do quantization by just applying the rule of path integral quantization to this new, more complicated object. So path integral quantization now, we have to write a path integral, namely an integral over histories of the field configuration with time. So basically, we have to define something which is going to be V of phi, which means this means integral over d phi of t with this big phi of t. But in the same sense that d phi of t is something which is like an integral of a product of all time of d phi of t, this is going to be a product of a time, a product over x of d phi of t and x. It's a measure on the space of field configuration in space-time. And then I have to write exponential simply of minus I over h bar, or I over h bar, s of phi. So out of this path integral, I'm going to be able to compute quantum properties, like quantum probabilities. So that's very naive because I've not specified what are the boundary conditions and what exactly is this measure. Okay. But that's the idea. Instead of dealing with the integral of a history of a trajectory, we consider some of a history of trajectory in configuration path of field. So you are integrating over field configuration in space-time. So this is going to be what's called a function or integration, because we integrate over all possible field configuration in space-time. Okay, we are going to see how this very abstract formulation can be used. Okay, but so that's a path integral at real time. You see that real time. Of course, we can do the same thing at imaginary time. And at imaginary time, what does it become? It becomes a path integral of a d phi Euclidean of exponential minus 1 over h bar Euclidean action s of phi Euclidean configuration, where here this means an integral over all the value of the Euclidean time tau, an integral over all possible value of x, the space of d by e of tau and x. Okay, so this is a path, typical path integral at real time for a quantum field. So let me call this z. And this is a typical path integral for a quantum field at a given time. Let me call it ze. So this is at imaginary time. Okay, so that's very vague, but that's the basic idea. And we'll see that, in fact, this leads to way to compute, for instance, correlation function of some operator in a much simpler way, a simpler way than canonical quantization. Of course, we are expecting to get the same result. But before that, let me just mention that, of course, in order to do that, you must be more careful. First, I've not specified what are the initial and final states, because this is useful to compute probability amplitudes. So, and that's tricky, because in fact, you may feel about what is an initial state for a field. And by analogy with quantum mechanics, you will expect that a good basis is a basis of localized state in configuration space. So you can expect that, let's say, that an initial state, call it phi, is just a wave function which specifies that the quantum field takes a value at time initial, let's say time zero, that phi of zero and x in the quantum field is given by this phi x. So let's call it phi initial. So you choose a classical field and in the path integral formulation you implement this boundary condition, and this corresponds in canonical quantization to a quantum state where you have a wave function on the space of old field configuration at a given time, which is a very big space. And but this wave function is localized at the field which takes this initial value. And that's something which is a bit difficult to imagine. And in addition, that's not what we need in quantum field theory. You have seen that in quantum field theory, you are interested, as we have seen in the QFT1 lectures, in initial state and finite states that are wave packets of particles, which are very different states than the states represented by this kind of states. And the relation between the two is non-trivial. There is, of course, a relation, but it's non-trivial. So it's something which is different from, very different from incoming, in, and out states with particles. With definite momenta. Okay. So that's the first subtle point. Well, the second subtle point is that we are dealing with a system which has an infinite degree of freedom. And yes?
Sorry, could you repeat that again? I could not understand the significance of...
Well, I mean that considering an initial state, which is a state which is localized in the space of fields, of classical fields, to a given field configuration, is something which is different from considering a quantum state whose, in some sense, wave function is localized in the state where you have just a finite number of incoming particles excited from the vacuum, which is things you are studying, and you need to study in collision amplitudes, for instance. So that's what you need in high energy physics. You don't need only that, but that's what you need in high energy physics. And the relation between those two kind of states is very non-local and very. Because for instance, in a state like that, the number of particles will not be fixed. We are dealing with a system which is second quantized, where the number of particles. I've not discussed at all what is a particle in this formulation yet. There are no particles. No particles yet. I'm going to come back.
In some sense, this is talking about like some sort of localization of the field itself.
Localization of the wave function over the space of fields. Not the field is not localized. So it's a bit tricky. I don't want to discuss that more, but I wanted to mention that. So that's one of the subtle points. Okay. So the second subtle point is that, of course, we are dealing with a system with an infinite number of degrees of freedom. Because you have one field per point of space-time. Of space. So if you feel uneasy about that, and that's in fact one way to derive everything precisely, you may think about discretizing space-time. And so instead of considering that your space-time that I've represented it is as one continuous space dimension and one continuous time dimension. Here I'm representing here just the 1+1 dimensional case. That's two-dimensional quantum field theory, one space, one time. You may think about first, consider that space-time, the space is discretized. So instead, I should like to have a okay, so space is discretized like that. So instead of having a continuous space-time, you have a finite number of points in your space. Well, not a finite, because it can be still infinite. But the field lives on a finite number of points. We have discretized space. So space is discretized. Goes from R to just, for instance, sets of integers. With a mesh A, let's call it A. So X is just I times A, with I belonging to Z, and I somewhat called space spatial cutoff. Okay. Now you may also think, when you define such a path integral quantization, in discretizing time. So you you consider that time instead of being so here I have a time discretization. But you have already seen in my lectures on quantum theory that in order to define properly, to derive properly the path integral quantization of Feynman, it's useful to discretize time and then take a continuum limit. So that's something which is already known in quantum mechanics, quantum theory already. You have seen that, okay? So you replace time by taking that time is some, let's call it G, some factor of G, times another cutoff, epsilon, time cutoff. But of course, since we start from a theory which is a Lorentz invariant, where time and space are related, it's quite natural to choose epsilon equal A. So now you have a square lattice in space-time. Of course, having a square lattice in space-time doesn't make your theory Lorentz invariant. But still, you keep a symmetry between space and time. Okay. And so, in this theory, you replace phi of x of t and x by something which is phi of I g with I g being a vector I in z to the power g in general. Well, g is time, so let me write this g and I, or g and I. Well, in fact, in general, I is vector in the dimension here. Okay, so you have replaced phi of t. And then this makes sense, but this gives you a specific form. So the calculation rule of quantum mechanics tells you what's the measure, and the measure becomes the measure d phi becomes just the products of all vectors. And let me write G and I as a big I belonging to ZD. So it's become a product of the points in Z to the power D on this infinite lattice. And then you get D phi of I. Now the field is defined independently on this each point of I. So this is a point here, I. Okay. And then if you work out the measure, you find that the measure is 2i pi h bar divided by this. I'm sorry, epsilon equal A, of course. So let me write this epsilon to the power dimension of space-time minus 2 times minus 1/2. So this is the explicit form of the measure or discretized space-time. Yes, you have a question.
How do we relate the classical initial configuration of the field we are integrating with the quantum field theory creation and annihilation operators we've handled?
I won't reply to this question now because we have to make the connection between the creation and annihilation operator, and I'm not speaking about particles and creation and annihilation operator. So I'll try to reply to that later. Okay? I don't have this question. Thank you. Maybe I should have mentioned, shouldn't have mentioned this at that level. But I think, okay. So now, of course, the same thing can be done for the Euclidean theory. And for the Euclidean theory, the difference between Euclidean time and real time is that the I factor disappears. So you could guess that for this Euclidean space-time measure, dE of phi is product over I. If you just have, you can discretize Euclidean space-time the same way. Now it's just an ordinary lattice in d-dimensional space, and that's going to be d phi Euclidean of I. And then, in fact, it's just that the I factor disappears. You get 2 pi h bar over epsilon d minus 2 to the power minus 1 half. Okay, that's discretized Euclidean space-time. Okay, so that's a proper step in defining precisely what we deal with that kind of functional integral, integral over phi. We have reduced an integral over an infinite continuous number of degrees of freedom in terms of an infinite but still discrete, now discrete degrees of freedom. So we go from continuous infinity degrees of freedom into a discrete but infinite number of degrees of freedom. Infinite number of degrees of freedom. Okay. Yes?
Sorry, I think I missed it. Where did, how do we get those factors?
Okay, that's an exercise. And I think I give the details in my lecture note, but that's a useful exercise. And of course, then of course you have to discretize the action too, because now, how do you discretize the action? Then the answer is very simple. If you have a lattice, how do we discretize the action? Both the action for phi that I wrote here and the Euclidean action. Well, the answer is very simple. You just replace ordinary derivative d over dx, let's say, here, by finite difference derivative. Namely, if you replace, for instance, in this case, you have phi of x, and you want to define what is this x in the a direction. A goes from 0 to d minus 1, so that's a continuous derivative. Now you replace phi by phi of I, because x is replaced by this epsilon space-time times a vector I with I belonging to z to the power d. So you replace what you call the discrete derivative in the direction A of I of x. Well, that's simply the difference between phi at I plus EA, where EA is a unit vector in the direction A, in the component A, minus phi of I, and divided by, of course, the step. So what does it mean? It means simply that if you have a lattice, you are at a point I here. You want to define what is the derivative of the discrete field in the direction A. A direction. The direction can be space-like or time-like. Then it's a difference between the value of the field at I plus EA and at the find A. And you define by the step A, epsilon. So if you replace here, of course, and then you have to replace dd of x by sum over I in zd of epsilon to the power d. So you sum over each set. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Okay. Yes, that's true. I forgot this trick. Okay, so, yeah, so it means that you replace, so finite difference I defined by the difference between the field here and the field here in the A direction divided by the distance, and the volume element is just associated to I, is just the volume of the cell, which is epsilon to the power d. So the action become, and I can, let's write it explicitly.
I think that's a good point.
So then, for instance, the discretized Euclidean action for a discretized field phi phi is just the sum of all the sides of the lattice. D of x becomes a factor epsilon d. Then you get the time and space derivative are replaced by one half of the square of the discrete finite difference derivative. So it comes to be 1 over epsilon, one half sum over all the direction from 0 to d minus 1. A labels the direction, the component in space time, of phi of E plus EA minus phi of I divided by epsilon. That's the finite difference derivative to the power squared. And when you sum from A equals 0 to D minus 1, the first time A equals 0 takes care of the difference, the derivative in the Euclidean time direction, and the remaining D minus 1 terms takes into account of the finite difference in the spatial directions. And then you get the term proportional to the mass parameter m, which is, of course, one half. And that's simply the square of the value of the field at a given size. So that's epsilon. That's phi of I squared. And same thing for the discretized action at real discretized time plus discretized space time. Okay. Yes.
Say about the mass?
Pardon?
What did you say about the mass? What?
No, the parameter m, I say. There is a, I'm sorry, forgot here. Yeah, I'm very sorry.
Oh.
This is, I forgot to write the mass. I spoke about it and therefore my brain went too fast. So that's m squared. The mass parameter in the Klein-Gordon equation appears here. And what you can notice is simply that, for instance, you see that the finite difference, the derivative terms, the finite difference comes with a factor epsilon d minus 2, while this comes with just an epsilon d term. And it's just dimensional analysis factor. Okay. So if you use this trick, you define your partition function or your functional integral as a functional integral where the field takes value at just the discretized point in space-time, and you have an action involving finite difference derivatives, which makes sense. Okay? So in this way, you get a functional integral with space-time discretization. Okay? Which makes more sense mathematically. And that's going to be useful for renormalization. So if I've detailed that a bit, that's not only because of mathematical safeness, but that's because to be useful. But of course, then, in order to recover a full-fledged quantum field theory with Lorentz invariance or with rotational Euclidean invariance in Euclidean space-time, you need to take the limit when epsilon equals A goes to zero. So to reduce the mesh of your space-time so that it becomes pi. Becomes a continuous space, and this is called the continuum limit. Or continuous limit. Or continuum. Limit for space-time. And formally, it seems that this limit should exist, but in fact, that's it might be problematic too. So you should keep in mind that there might be problems lurking in this limit. And we'll discuss that when discussing renormalization theory. Okay? Okay, well, I don't think I'm going. Okay, so I won't have time. So, okay, so let me just then end up the lecture by discussing another possible problems. Here, I've discussed the fact that in order to make things properly defined, you need to discretize space-time. And this means changing the nature of space-time at short distance. So this is called often a short distance or an ultraviolet regularization of the series. So this procedure of discretized space-time is called also ultraviolet regularization. Ultraviolet becomes, in the language of energy, are the inverse of wavelengths in quantum theory. Changing the structure of space-time at short distance means changing the structure of the theory at high energy. Okay, so that's high energy means ultraviolet in the language of an electromagnetic spectrum with respect to infrared. Okay. So now let me mention another kind of regularization which we might have to do, which is called large distance and time infrared regularization. Because we started from a quantum theory we want to define for time, but also for continuous space. So space is infinite. And we might encounter problems if space is infinite. This might lead to some problems, which reflect some physical quantities of the theory, not mathematical, but physical problems, or at least, questions or issues. Okay, so you might be tempted, and that's useful often, to make space-time finite. And in particular, to make space finite. So to make space finite means put the theory, the quantum theory, in a box, in a spatial box. So you have a fit theory, and it's in a box. And I think with a you have studied that in the case, for instance, of the Casimir effect in canonical quantization. You put electromagnetic field or inside two plates. That's an example of infrared or large distance regularization. Okay. But you may also put your theory on a cylinder. It's, of course, not very physical, except for some solid state device, but you may consider that your space is periodic. The space, instead of being rd minus 1, becomes the torus d minus 1, which means the torus times d minus 1. With a dimension L. Okay. So again, so you replace your space in the box with dimension L by a torus with diameter, well, not diameter, but total length L, by enforcing that phi t of x plus some L times some vector m, where m belongs to z d minus 1, is equal to phi t of x. So you impose periodic condition in space. Okay? And that's both physical if you consider a system in a finite, a field in a finite system, and that's useful for mathematics. Okay? So that's about making space finite. What about making time finite? Well, we have already seen that it might be useful to make time finite when dealing with Euclidean time. Because having Euclidean time periodic with period capital T is equivalent to dealing with a finite temperature Let's call it P, because T, finite temperature. T with a relation that I wrote here between the period, which is here, tau, and the temperature. So P, or if you want, KBT, the temperature is h bar divided by the period. Okay? And so it's useful, and I'm going to consider this sometimes, to consider the following system. I consider a theory which is defined on a torus. See? So where this is Euclidean time with period P, and so the boundary condition is that the value of the phi here is equal to the value of the phi here, so this is in fact a cylinder in the time direction. In addition, in the space direction, I consider a period L, so L is just the spatial extension of the system, with here again periodic boundary condition. And so my space-time is now a d-dimensional torus with period P in one direction and period L in the other direction. And of course, you might choose to have P equal L in order to have symmetry between the different components. Okay? So, and this kind of modification of theory is a large distance modification. So it's called an infrared regularization. And of course, this is completely independent of the ultraviolet regularization. So you may choose to modify the boundary condition of your theory at large distance. You may choose to also modify the theory at short distance by making a space-time discrete at short distance, with a cutoff epsilon, okay? And of course, in order to recover a quantum theory in infinite dimensional space-time, you need to take both the epsilon goes to zero and the large distance limit, L equal P goes to infinity. So when doing explicit calculation, if you are not sure of what you are doing, you can just use this trick, because in this, using this regularization, the path integral becomes a finite dimensional integral. So the integral over d phi becomes a finite integral over a finite number of variables, the value of the field at each point in space-time. And the number of integral is, of course, p divided by epsilon, where epsilon is a time regulator, times L divided by A, if you choose an A regulator, which can be different from epsilon, to the power d minus 1, which is finite. Okay, that's straightforward, but that's a good way to define a finite dimensional over functions and take the continuum and the large distance limit by taking epsilon goes to zero and L equals P and LNP goes to infinity. Unless you want to deal with a quantum field theory at finite temperature. So quantum field theory at finite temperature means that you want to keep epsilon equal A equal zero, L equal infinity, but P still finite. You see the logic. I have not been doing any calculation. I just want to show you the logic. Okay, let's end there. And on Thursday, I'm going to show how this very well received, but at the moment I've not calculated anything. I've just defined object, allows to recover in a quick way results that you obtain by canonical quantization of the scalar free field, in particular, it's called the Green function, so the correlation function, so the vacuum expectation value of time ordered products of field operators using this path integral formalism. So that's what we are going to do in the next lecture. Thank you.